Welcome to Unbreak My Chart, the podcast that tapes the top 10 and talks about it at school the next day. And on this week's agenda, we have an interactive Eurovision special with voices from all around the world. We've got a new number one, that's always exciting, and the mashup we have all been waiting for. I'm Fraser McAlpine.
I am Laura Snopes. How are you, Fraser?
I'm good. I'm really good. I'm so excited about this week because we've got voices from actual listeners to Unbreak My Chart and they're contributing, and we've never had more than just the two of us before. So it's quite cool, isn't it?
Yes, really exciting to get everybody emailing their links through. Thank you so much, by the way, to everybody who left us iTunes reviews after we asked last week. It really does help in surprising ways. So if you haven't got around to it yet and you're thinking of doing one, please do add it when you can. So we record this on Sunday nights, so last night was Eurovision. Last week I think I mentioned the presentation that Tom Ewing did at the conference I went to in Seattle, and I said I didn't know if he was going to put it online, but he has now put it online as a brilliant kind of YouTube composite of him speaking in his PowerPoint presentation. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes, because if you have any interest in Eurovision, and even if you don't, it's well worth watching. It's really, really funny.
Now, am I right in thinking that at the end of Eurovision, the guy who won from Portugal did an Alex Turner? Is that what happened?
Yes. We were going to count down the top 10 quickly, mostly to kind of challenge our terrible European pronunciation, but should we do that quickly?
Okay, let's do that. Number 10 is Grab the Moment by Joust, which is Norway's entry.
Number 9 is Australia with Don't Come Easy by Isaiah Firebrace, who has an extraordinary name.
Number 8 is Origo by... See, I've fallen over at the second hurdle. Origo by Josie Papai, but it was Hungary's entry.
At number 7 is the frankly extraordinary Yodel It by Ilinka featuring Alex Florea from Romania. I only tuned in halfway through Eurovision because I'd been out and I was a bit sleepy, but that one definitely broke through my like late evening doziness. I would really recommend looking this up. It was a mixture of yodeling and rap. And at the end, the guy who I assume is Alex Florea kissed Ilinka very powerfully, kind of like mushing her entire face up, and she wasn't ready for it. It's quite horrible. It's quite horrendous.
I've seen that gif. Also, is there a point at which they go from yo 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 into actually yo 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 delay he who?
Yes,
oh,
they
brilliant.
Do.
Good, good. That's clearly where the inspiration came from. Well done, everyone. Number 6 is Occidentali's Karma by Francesco Gabani from Italy.
And at number 5 is I Can't Go On by Robin Bengtsson from Sweden. Now, this was the performance where it appeared to be a number of Marks & Spencer's autograph models dancing on treadmills. And we have a guest review from Emma, who is going to talk about this one for us.
My name is Emma Kelly, I live in London, and my favourite song this Eurovision is Sweden's entry, I Can't Go On by Robin Bengtsson. Sweden kill it every year, I always cannot wait to see what they come up with, and I Can't Go On is another banger. It's a really solid choice from Sweden. The chorus is great, the dance routine contains the OK emoji, which is an absolute stroke of genius. The production is slick, it's what we expect from Sweden, and it's an absolute crowd pleaser. There's even the performance on treadmills, so whether he performs it perfectly, that's great. If he falls off, even better, everyone will remember it. It's pure pop, and I think that's what Sweden really bring to the contest. You could always depend on them, and it's perfect for Eurovision.
Thank you very much, Emma. At number 4 was City Lights by Blanche from Belgium.
At number 3 is Hey Mama by the Sunstroke Project from Moldova.
Number 2 is Beautiful Mess by Christian Kostov from Bulgaria.
Who was very good, a very young kind of, I think he was like 17, this young emo looking boy who was kind of like a one man hurts. 17 doesn't seem that young for a pop star to me, but when I was watching last night, we had the Graham Norton commentary on, and he seemed completely perplexed that anybody under the age of 20 could be any kind of functioning adult, let alone pop star. Every time one came on, he was like, ooh, they're so young. And it's like, you're not familiar with the fact that like most of our biggest pop stars did start when they were teenagers? It was quite funny. The winner was Amar Pelos Duis by Salvador Sobral from Portugal, which we're going to hear some of.
Meu bem, ouve as minhas preces, peço que regresses, que me voltes a querer. Eu sei que não se ama sozinho, talvez devagarinho, possas voltar ao prender.
We also have a guest review from Luca, who singled this out as a favourite before the final took place. Over to Luca.
Hello, my name is Luca and I'm from Brazil, where currently Maiara e Maraisa are at number one with Sorte Que Cê Beija Bem. But I'm talking about Portugal's Eurovision entry, Amar Pelos Dois by Salvador Sobral. I've seen people say that it's just a simple ballad, but I really think it's a beautiful ballad. I think the lyrics are great, and anyone who doesn't speak Portuguese should take a look at a translation. The arrangement really is kind of old-fashioned, but I don't really mind that. I think that it's a small song, but the strings go really big. And it feels like in the performance where Salvador is wearing a kind of oversized jacket. It's like the big rush of emotions that can make someone feel really small.
I thought that was a really lovely review. I particularly like that last bit. The big rush of emotions that can make someone feel really small. And Luca also wrote a bit more in an email, which he sent after the competition. Even though this was my favourite entry, I felt kind of ambiguous about the win after his scumbag rockist speech. Those are quite strong words, but for anybody who missed it, after he won, Salvador said, "We live in a world of disposable music. This is a vote for people who actually mean something with their music. Music is not fireworks. Music is feeling. So let's try to do this and bring music back."
Hang on. Music is fireworks. Music is fireworks. What? Why isn't music fireworks? That's an insane thing to say. What's wrong with fireworks? I'm so appalled by this.
Also, I know, is he really trying to use Eurovision, the most fireworky, glitzy, campy, over-the-top music event of the entire year, anywhere in the entire world, as some kind of Trojan horse for real music?
He's like that guy who won the X Factor with a hat on that pretended to be a painter and decorator in order to get in and then tried to maintain he was authentic. And you're like, you're not even a real painter and decorator. What the hell are you talking about authenticity for? You strange man. I can't even remember his name. You know the one with the hat on.
Is it Matt Cardle?
Yes, Matt Cardle, him, yes.
Luca also continued, "That awful kind of thinking is still very common and makes me very wary about the recent trend of think pieces saying poptimism is just as bad as rockism. Poptimism is still crucial because music isn't fast food and great music can be fireworks." There you go,
good.
Fraser.
Well done,
great
Luca.
Music can be emotion. Great music can be a whole lot of things. The real lesson from today wasn't supposed to be about this very narrow definition of what music should be. Celebrate diversity, which was Eurovision's motto this year, got lost along the way.
This is interesting that this seems to have blown up because there was a piece on The Quietest this week by Michael Hann, and he was making the claim, the exact claim that Luca references here, that poptimism, which to anybody that doesn't know what it is it's essentially trying to treat pop music, chart pop music, with the same kind of excitement and reverence and cultural heft as rock music had grown accustomed to, but also with it came a certain amount of raised eyebrow to the automatic veneration of people just because they happen to have guitars or whatever. It's a similar thing, you know, when rock and roll came along and replaced jazz. Essentially all the jazzers were going, this stuff is juvenile and infantile and it won't last, and all the rock and rollers were like, we don't care, up yours. And then after a while those rock and rollers were like, well, what we've done is create art here, I don't know what anybody else thinks. And then pop essentially came along and went, are we art? And all the rock people went, no, you're not art, look at you, children like what you do, and got really snarky about it. So poptimism sort of seeks to address that. It's a strain of critical thinking within the music writer fraternity. Michael Hann's piece in places was sort of trying to say that poptimists are as prescriptive as rockists, and that there are sacred cow artists who are beyond critical reproach. And I don't know if that's true. I said this on Twitter and I got some reactions because I thought it was quite well argued in a way, but I mainly read it to see if I was doing anything wrong myself. And I read it through and I went, nope, I'm fine. I don't do any of this stuff. I'm very critical about people I don't like because I know my own taste, and it's fine to, you know, at one minute to say this Beyonce song isn't my cup of tea, but also I'm not into the Stereophonics either. And sometimes to say, wow, this Taylor Swift song is flipping marvellous. But then also to listen to Mark Lanegan from The Screaming Trees. So, you know, it's an odd piece in that, because I don't know that it actually accurately reflects what writers do, or people who listen to music do.
Mm. It didn't really seem to have anything specific in its sites. If you were marking it as a university essay, I think it would go back with red pen and the word citation question mark all over it.
Oh yeah, it didn't link to anything. It didn't link to any other articles which were committing the crimes that were being referenced, and that's a big problem.
Yes, totally. And also I'd been thinking for probably a few years now that the terms poptimism and rockism are basically useless at this point, because it is an accepted fact that everybody listens to a bit of everything. Yeah. Unless you're, you know, like a man in his 50s who's still buying Mojo magazine every week and does look at pop music and think, oh, this is terrible. I think most people have much more diverse music there. And actually, citing, like, you know, 50-year-old men, my dad isn't a Mojo reader, but he subscribes to a streaming service and he listens to a wide variety of terrible music, not just rock, not just pop, indiscriminately bad music.
I've just finished reading Tim Burgess's second book, which is the one where he goes from record shop to record shop, talking to himself about how wonderful vinyl is and trying to find certain records that were recommended to him by his very famous friends. And if that sounds like a faintly barbed description of the book, it does get a little wearing after a while. I mean, I really like his enthusiasm and all that stuff, but he says a few times in the book, oh, well, you can definitely tell what someone's personality is like from the kind of music they like. And if they don't like this particular artist, then why even bother being friends with them and stuff? And it always just gets my hackles up, because I just think people just like what they like. They just like what they like. I think one of them was My Bloody Valentine. And I just think, well, it's a proper litmus test band, that one. They're a very difficult band for some people to get around in terms of what they expect from music. And that idea that you should like a band is always the death knell, because there will always be people who just feel a little bit left behind by whoever the great critically lauded everybody loves them band of the moment are. My thing was always with that was always the Arcade Fire or Arcade Fire. You're not supposed to put the that in. They always left me on the island. I've never liked anything they've done ever, but I never thought that meant it doesn't mean anything. I just didn't like them. It's fine. I'm allowed not to like them. I don't particularly worry that Tim Burgess is going to come around and say, hey, where's all the Arcade Fire records in your record collection? I'm going now. But I used to worry that Bobby Gillespie would come around and judge me for not having the right records. And then I thought, why am I hanging on to these records? I don't need them. I don't really like them.
Yeah, I think the only musical opinion that would stop me wanting to be friends with anybody is one exactly like the one that Tim Burgess has just espoused, saying that he wouldn't be friends with somebody on the basis of their record collection. Anybody who thinks that, I wouldn't be friends with.
So, having tidied up all of critical theory, let's move on to the top 10.
So at number 10 this week is Sign of the Times by Harry Styles, whose debut album came out a few days ago, but we've decided we're going to save any discussion of that for next week's chart, possibly because he might do a kind of Sheeran type invasion, but we were just having a look at his Spotify stats and we reckon that's pretty much not going to happen, don't we?
I would be really surprised if there was anything like that, but you never know. I think he's definitely been talked about more than he's been listened to.
Yeah, I think the fact that Sign of the Times is bottoming out of the top 10 already after not a huge amount of time in the charts, and the fact that Sweet Creature didn't make it into the top 10, I would be surprised if there was maybe like one or two songs by him in the top 10 next week.
So moving on, number 9 is Solo Dance by Martin Jensen, which has actually gone up. So it is definitely not bottoming out of the charts.
And at number 8 is Unforgettable by French Montana featuring Swae Lee.
So that's an unusual song, isn't it? And one of the unusual things about it is that Swae Lee's sung bits are much, much swearier than French Montana's rapped bits. And that's not how it normally works. Normally, there's a singer who is kind of the innocent, benign, unsweary hook moment. And then the rapper comes in and Fs and Jeffs all over the place to street things up a bit. So that's an unusual turnaround. Their views on marriage are kind of interesting as well. Swae mentions giving it to her like we in a marriage, which presumably means begrudgingly and only on special occasions.
I really like this song. I really like how muted it is. I feel like it's one of the only, like, even halfway downbeat songs, apart from maybe Sign of the Times, that's been in the top 10 since we've started doing this. I mean, I don't just mean downbeat like sad, but something that's kind of got more of a black and white colour palette, as opposed to being, everything else has been quite colourful, I think. It's not just like, everybody's like incorporating bits of dancehall into their singles at the moment, but I feel like a lot of people do it as a kind of cheap byword for like cheerfulness. But I thought that this had a bit of depth to it. I don't know, maybe it was just the drums in it, but it also reminded me a bit of Gosh by Jamie XX, which I really enjoyed. But yeah, I thought this was great.
Yeah, it's sort of thrillingly minimal, really, and it doesn't sound like someone's trying to make a little advert out of Ghosts, which is sort of the predominant musical theme of the moment.
Yes, it's nothing like the song at number 7.
No, Swallow by Jason Derulo featuring Nicki Minaj and Ty Dolla Sign, which is filthy and stupid, and I secretly like it.
At number 6 is Galway Girl by Ed Sheeran. Now, anybody who's been listening to Unbreak My Chart every week will know that several weeks ago we were talking about how Galway Girl has a bit of tub thumping about it, and we wondered what it would like if the two songs were stuck together. Well, Unbreak My Chart listener and now forever friend of the show, Paddy, has mashed it up for us, and it sounds just like this.
He drinks a whiskey drink, he drinks a vodka drink, he drinks a lager drink, he drinks a cider drink. He sings the songs that remind him of the good times, he sings the songs that remind him of the better times.
Favorite part of it is every time a new part of the song starts, like by the time it was the beer drink and lager drink part, I had lost it by that point. Thank you so much, Paddy.
Yeah, that's astonishing, Paddy. Thank you very, very much. That's given the song a whole new lease of life, which it did not deserve. So that's astonishing. I think because we put the link up to the mashup in the week, it did spark another email from Sive, who wanted to talk about Tub Thumping by Chumbawamba. And what she said was, in episode 5, you draw parallels between Tub Thumping and Galway Girl, which are very valid, but I wonder if you're doing Chumbawamba a disservice. There's a US podcast called Surprisingly Awesome, presented by Adam Davidson and Adam McKay, who, among other things, Adam McKay wrote Anchorman with Will Ferrell. So he's proper Hollywood. They did a whole episode about Chumbawamba, and although it's been a while since I listened to it, the crux of the matter is that the band were deliberately trying to commercialise their music so that they could take down capitalism,
very successful.
Yeah, well, it's all gone now. Capitalism's been packed away, and we've been replaced by anarcho-syndicalism, and we're all fine. In this sense, they paved the way for self-aggrandizing list makers like Sheeran. For them, it was a means to a greater good, however misguided the approach may have been, and the lyrics about the alcoholic man were meant to be the common man just trying to make his way through the world, translated into popular culture. But for Sheeran, the deliberate cash cow is wrapped in a veneer of relatability that sells it. Now, there's a couple of things about that. One, I should say from the start, is if you do listen to the Surprisingly Awesome podcast about Chumbawamba featuring Adam McKay, who wrote Anchorman, I'm one of the people they've interviewed on that. And I only was interviewed because they went looking for anybody that written anything positive about Chumbawamba when Chumbawamba split up a few years ago. And I'd written a piece for the BBC America blog Anglophenia about Chumbawamba, just trying to put them in a context that wasn't just Tub Thumping, because I remembered that they came out of squat punk and they were a band that tried to fuse pop melodies with the politics of punk, and yes, you know, there was a deliberate attempt to try and make their politics move into or have a place in mainstream listening habits. So they were big with samplers. Hip-hop was really inspirational to them. They were writing proper pop songs, not agit punk, and trying to get people to, you know, listen. And it was ferocious stuff as well, about the way that post the miners' strike, the way that left-wing thinking had changed and the way that society had turned on working-class communities. And that is not how people remember Tub Thumping. It's not how people think about that song. And the whole podcast is literally about why it's more important to consider Tub Thumping as being the last howl of working class outrage against the effects of the Conservative government of the 1980s than it is just a silly novelty song about getting down when you're drunk and then getting back up again. It's about people, you know, working class communities getting knocked down by the state and then pulling themselves back up again because they've got pride and community and all of that stuff. And none of that is in Galway Girl whatsoever, and nobody's looking for it either. But and I should also say I don't blame Sai for not recognising that I'm in it, because although I was interviewed for an hour and a half and talked about Tub Thumping, they used one sentence from that.
Oh, wow.
in the whole podcast, and it wasn't a particularly long one either. So yeah, I mean, check it out. It's worth listening to if you're at all interested in Chumbawamba. But that is not why we fused Galway Girl with Tub Thumping. It was purely a sonic coincidence.
Well, Ed Sheeran does like to come out and claim like retrospective authorship over everything, whether it's like TLC's No Scrubs or saying that he originally wrote X song for Y person. He's always got to retrospectively explain things. So I wouldn't put it past him to reappear in a few weeks once the hoo-ha from the video has died down, and him saying that actually it's deeply political and it's about trying to reconcile the differences between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland.
Speaking of which, though, did you see that Harry Styles has come out with another meaning for Sign of the Times?
No.
he said it was about Brexit and what was the other thing? I can't remember, but because there was a point at which I was just like, oh, you're just having a laugh now.
Was it Brexit and Black Lives Matter? I think it was,
yes,
in the New
Black
York
Lives
Times
Matter,
interview,
that's right.
Where it's great, the journalist, so I think it's Joe Coscarelli, says to him like, you know, while you were writing this album, lots of bad things were going on in the world, like Brexit and the things that Black Lives Matter was responding to. Did any of that go into the writing? And Harry Styles is like, yeah, there was lots of bad things happening last year. And a lot of them really did feature into the writing. And the journalist is like, well, which ones? And he's like, you know, all those ones you just mentioned. It was some classic hedge betting.
Harry, you do get to a point where you start to wonder with Harry Styles whether he is enormously enigmatic or whether he's just refusing to talk to people when they're asking him questions, because his interview style is very much, I'm just going to give you the very, very barest minimum of information that I can get away with, and at the end of it I'm going to smile, and that's what you're getting.
Yeah, there is he's on the cover of, I think, the Sunday Times magazine today, and it's a perfectly enjoyable piece, but the writer says in it that they were together for 3 hours, and you think, wow, if these are the quotes that you've put in the piece, what does the rest of your transcript look like? I just thought, was this like pulling teeth? Because it's very affable. It's like, it's quite enjoyable, but it's not meaty, let's put it that way.
No, and he's not someone who is a great orator. And it's just that we didn't know that what he claimed Sign of the Times was about. And then he said it was about the mother and the baby and all of that, that didn't seem to fit the lyrics. And to make any other suggestion that it's about Brexit and Black Lives Matter or whatever is just like, yeah, what you need to say, Harry, is you can attach any meaning to it that you wish.
Yeah.
And not try and add your own strange interpretations to your own lyrics, which, you know, suggests that even you don't listen to your own words.
Well, at number five is a song of fathomless depth, equally fathomless depth. It's There's Nothing Holding Me Back by Shawn Mendes.
At number four is Shape of You by Ed Sheeran.
At number three is Symphony by Clean Bandit featuring Zara Larsson.
Which means we have number two, last week's number one, I'm the One, which should now be retitled I'm the Two, by DJ Khaled featuring Justin Bieber, Quavo, Chance the Rapper and Lil Wayne. And as we said last week, it's a perfect song for making love to yourself too while you watch. Each guest verse is like opening a door into different rooms in a clinic where people are receiving treatment for excessive narcissism. What does it say about the times in which we live that a song in which four different people claim to be the one can be such a high charting single? They're not even arguing about who is the one, Laura. They're just ignoring one another and saying, actually, I'm the one and here's why.
This is one of the thinnest, despite how many people are on it, it's one of the thinnest singles I've heard in an incredibly long time. It's It's so meaningless. Nobody could possibly be paying any attention to anything that is being said in the song. I think it's just like the faintest dog whistle that says, at some point in the future, summer will arrive. You can prepare yourself to it by listening to this mindless, asinine song. There's Chris Malamphy is a great writer for Slate, the website, who I think we've mentioned a couple of times because he's the big American chart expert. And he also recently started a podcast at Slate called Hit Parade, which is very good. Deconstructs how songs you like and dislike became great hits. And he wrote a brilliantly withering piece on this song this week. And he points out that it is the first ever American number one credited to as many as 5 artists. The previous record was 4 on the 2001 remake of Lady Marmalade by Christina Aguilera, Little Kim, Maya and Pink. And the 2011 Pitbull chart topper Give Me Everything, which featured Neo, Afrojack and Naya. He says, I'm the One is, in essence, the big pop chart's first ever number one posse cut, a rap form with a long, rich tradition, as well as the posse cut's ultimate bowdlerization into an exercise in hip-hop brand management.
Which is what you said last week, when you said it was SEO. What did we? I can't remember the rest of it.
SEO pop. Yeah.
Props to you, Laura, because that's a better way of putting it.
Thanks. Well, he has got some humdingers in this article. He says that it is the summer music equivalent of an Adam Sandler aging buddies flick like Grown Ups 2, which I thought was very good.
Yeah, it's basically hung on the fact that people love Justin Bieber at the moment, and he can just about get away with claiming to be the one, although it does emphasise the charmless elements of his personality. And when I say elements, I mean totality of his personality, as he does appear to be something of a charmless individual. Very, very handsome man, not particularly.
No!
Nice. Well, I mean, you can't get around that's surely the hook upon which the entire Justin Bieber enterprise is founded. If he looked like me and sounded like that, I suspect he would sell slightly fewer records.
Well, he is also at number one this week with Despacito by Luis Fonsi and Daddy Yankee. You fit me, tell me, love how you put it on. Got the only key, know how to turn it on. The way you nibble on my ear, the only words I wanna hear. Baby, take it slow so we can last long. Tú eres el imán y yo soy el metal. Me voy acercando y voy armando el plan. Solo con pensarlo se acelera el pulso. Oh yeah. Ya me está gustando más de lo normal. Todos mis sentidos van pidiendo más. Esto hay que tomarlo sin ningún apuro. Despacito, quiero respirar tu cuello despacito. Deja que te diga cosas al oído, para que te acuerdes si no estás conmigo. I have a feeling this song is going to be sticking around for a really, really long time, and we're going to have to come up with a lot of things to say about it. But to spare you, I was pontificating about South American pop music. We have a guest review this week from Ana Clara, who is a brilliant journalist in Brazil, who is always sending us really fascinating tidbits about her home charts. So over to you, Ana.
Hey Fraser, hey Laura, this is Ana, your friendly neighborhood journalist from Brazil. And I'm here to talk about Despacito, which is a worldwide phenomenon, but it's getting some pretty peculiar contours here in Brazil. Currently, the song is number one in the charts. It overcame the juggernaut, Shape of You by Ed Sheeran. And the thing is, you probably imagine that since we are part of Latin America, that Latin music is a pretty big deal here and has a lot of hits. It actually doesn't. There are very few songs that I remember, that I recall, and I checked on Billboard on the last years. The ones that I can remember are pretty much the same as the ones that you can remember there in England. It's Shakira on her Spanish Face, is Ricky Martin, and most specifically is Daddy Yankee with Gasolina, and that forms a really interesting bridge with Despacito, and I think that that familiarity with the artist might have been a really important factor on the success that Despacito had. But I think that the biggest factor is actually not Justin Bieber, like many people say, but it's that what people look for in hits is the mixture of familiarity in smaller, in bigger doses, and a bit of exoticness in smaller doses. And I think that Brazilian artists and cultural figures are starting to include a bit of a reggaeton influence, including Anitta that I sent to you guys earlier this year. It's starting to put a lot of reggaeton influence in their work. So the sound that Despacito brings to the table is something that is already coming to roost in Brazil through very small medicinal doses. And when Despacito came, it doesn't sound foreigner. It doesn't sound weird. It sounds like Anitta with Maluma, which is a reggaeton artist that had a very small participation in a hit here. And so I think that this penetration in the culture is starting to happen through the minds of the people that write music in Brazil.
Time for new releases now. There's a couple to look at this week. First of all, Miley Cyrus is back. She's back with a new song called Malibu.
I always thought I would sing, so I never swam. I never went boating, don't get how the air floating. And sometimes I get so scared of what I can't understand. But here I am, next to you. Sky is more blue in Malibu next to you.
Heartbreaking Miley is the best Miley. The mad kind of actually all of Miley's songs are fairly heartbreaking. Wrecking Ball was the most heartbreaking, had the most drama in it. We Can't Stop, I've always said, is the most heartbreaking song to listen to, because while she is claiming to have the best time in the world with her lyrics, her voice is saying, help me, help me, help me, help me. I'm in a party. I don't want to be in this party. I've partied too long. She's like that wriggling worm in Futurama that drinks slurm and parties all the time. And really, when you get behind the shades, it's like, help me, I'm stuck in this eternal party nightmare. That's what her voice is saying. The words are saying something completely different. So I like Miley Cyrus because of that quality to her voice, and it's sort of a stern voice. It's a Stevie Nicks kind of half elf, half goblin, with total authority and really emotional. And it sort of spans, you know, the gap between earthly pleasures and divine treasures. This song isn't as time stopping as Wrecking Ball, and it may serve her well in the public eye because people do like a former Disney wild child when they start to settle down and admit that perhaps they'd gone off the rails a little bit. But I don't know if Miley's going to actually admit that stuff, but the song sounds a lot more conciliatory than anything she's released before.
Well, I think this song ties into the public image of like the reconciliation with the boyfriend or fiance that she had dumped in the midst of all of the madness of the last record. It's them like engaged again, settled down, maybe living back in Tennessee or something like that. She's not getting toe tattoos from Wayne Coyne anymore. I think it's very sanitizing, but I mean I don't mind the song. It's like, it's perfectly bland, and I do like her voice. I really wanted her to make a hard-bitten country album for quite a while, but something about this coming after the ridiculous, you know, inflatable unicorns and debauchery of the bangers era, hearing her do this Malibu thing now kind of rings more false to me than any of that like inflatable ridiculousness of what she was doing before. It's not that I think that she doesn't mean it, but I think it shows kind of the way that she treats different aesthetics as being totally disposable. And that's fine, and that is what pop stars should do. But it seemed like on the last record she had made such a wholehearted commitment to, well, A, tripping balls every day, but B, hip-hop. And for her to come back this time, and I think it was in an interview with Billboard magazine where she said that she was actually over hip-hop and it was all really misogynistic. It's like, I don't know, it just left a really, really bad taste. The fact that she's gone from the kind of cliched portrayal of a wild child, which she's now disavowing in mildly racist terms, and then embracing kind of like white cotton lace dresses and dancing in cornfields and stuff. I thought there were undertones to that that went beyond the usual kind of like image flipping of a Madonna style pop star. But I don't hate the song.
No, you've watched the video though, haven't you?
Yes. Oh yeah, which you don't do.
No, so there is a difference. But I can imagine that, I mean, so basically the soberness that comes across from the music is replicated within the video, is it? Because I was slightly worried that it was going to be another one where, you know, the thing with Wrecking Ball is that it's a really, really sad song in a really ludicrous video that ruins it. So it I take it the video and the song are a closer alignment this time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So one of the other new releases that is out this week is Bedroom by Mabel.
You can
know they see me from the waist down. And I know that you can only want me when I lay down. You only ever need me when the light's out. Now I'm stuck in the dark, 'cause you've taken it too far. So I broke your guitar up against your television, and I smashed every glass that you had in your kitchen. Why don't we turn up our phones for the weekend? Don't tell friends that we haven't been sleeping, 'cause we're keeping it secret. You can only see me in the
I think I've mentioned Mabel on the podcast before as one of my most streamed songs of the week. I think I picked Finders Keepers, but this is her new single, which is off an EP, which I think is also called Bedroom. And I think it's brilliant. It really, really reminds me of... She reminds me of everything you wanted Mutia from the Sugar Babes solo career to be. Like, this girl who is really cool, has got that great husky delivery, but also seems like she could... F you up if she really wanted to. And she does that in this song. She really gets revenge. It's I think the lyrics in it are great. It's about being with a guy who kind of seems to maybe keep her under lock and key a little bit, and they have these very thorny weekends where they seem to have a lot of sex and not very much else, and the relationship doesn't seem to be particularly healthy, and she wants to get out of it but doesn't really know how. And then in the chorus she sings about how she smashed his guitar against his television, which I have read in an interview she actually did. So I think the transitions of power in the lyrics are really exciting, but also I love the pace of the song, the way that time seems to slow when the chorus hits, and yeah, that kind of gimlet eye delivery that she has. I think she's great.
No, she's wonderful. And as opening lines go, "You can only see me from the waist down" is astonishingly good. It's right up there with Billy Bragg's "With the money from her accident, she bought herself a mobile home" as a scene setter. Because once you've heard "You can only see me from the waist down," it's like, right, I'm sold. Wherever we're going with this, whatever this story is, I need to hear what the rest of it is, where we're going, whether this is going to be, you know, "And so I'm breaking up with you," or "And this is the problem with our relationship, and yet I can't stop sleeping with you," or whatever it is, I want to know more about it. And to write a song with this much kind of breathy sort of boudoir fug musically in it, but make the lyrics about feeling undervalued for anything but sex, that's kind of brilliant pop work. That's young mind at work as well. Young girls are going to latch onto that in a big way, I think.
Yeah, I'm a really big fan. I think she's playing live soon. I'm very excited to see her. So, Fraser, what was your most streamed song this week?
Well, I've taken Michael Hand's advice to heart, really. I've given up on pop music and gone rockist. I've genuinely really enjoyed the second half of the new Kasabian album. First half is fairly typical Kasabian stuff. Second half, the songs seem to get better, more interesting twists and turns. I always thought they were slightly more interesting than people give them credit for anyway. And I also think that they are slightly more unhinged than the idea that they're just somehow rock classicists and they only ever do stuff based on precedent. Some of that is just based on Serge and his interview technique, which is largely just to cite other bands that are doing things similarly to things that he's now doing, which is, you know, as if that's a defence. It's like a legal defence. It's what solicitors do. But yeah, so I think this got Bless This Acid House, which is the standout track for me on the second half of the Kasabian album, is just really good power pop. And to, you know, as Serge would describe it, like Badfinger or the Raspberries, yeah? Rowdy, and it sort of fits what I like about Kasabian, which is when they do crass things that other heritage rockers would not do, like the bright pink album cover, Serge's t-shirts with different slogans on them, and the cover for the album, the new album for Crying Out Loud, which is a silly cover, but people are reacting to that cover as if it's the most ludicrous thing they've ever seen. And they clearly have never seen the cover of the Stereophonics album, Keep Calm and Carry On, which genuinely is the most ludicrous thing you've ever seen. Because it's done seriously. It's done as a serious person's idea of a joke. And it's awful for that. Whereas the Kasabian thing is just ludicrous, and that's great. The only thing that's wrong with the Kasabian album cover, which features that one of their roadies pretending to cry while
I thought it was cartooned. George Galloway. That's who it looks like.
It does look like George Galloway. It's one of their roadies, and he and they love him as well. It's a guy that they really genuinely love, and they're really thrilled to feature him on their album cover. He's pretending to cry, and there are cartoon tears coming all over. It's like showering the image that you see. The only thing that's wrong with it is that they've decided to put in brackets after the album title the year 2017, and I just think that's a Nathan Barleyism too far. But the rest of it, I'm totally behind them. I think they should be more mad. The madder Kasabian are, the more I like them.
I am inclined to agree. I love them when they first came out, and then when I was exposed to them through professional means a lot of the time, like frequently, it made me truly hate them and everything that I felt that they represented. But I've actually softened on them. I think that they are inventive, silly men, and their sense of humour should probably be celebrated. They're not like, I don't think they're anything like the Last Shadow Puppets or, I don't know, the Cortinas or anything like that. I do think that they seem like good, fun guys.
So Laura, what's your song of the week?
Well, it's by some good time fun guys. it's, which is a cruel joke to make because they are fun guys. They're very nice people. I would be a terrible fan if I did not pick The System Only Dreams in Total Darkness by The National. Why are you hiding from me? We're in a different kind of thing now. All night you're talking to God. I love this song. The National are my favourite band, which anybody who's ever followed me on the internet is probably aware of. Their last album, Trouble Will Find Me, which came out in 2013, I really liked, obviously, but I did feel like it was, the pace was getting a bit more mellow, it was getting a bit more piano, kind of ballad heavy, and it felt like guys kind of easing into middle age a little bit more, and I thought, okay, I mean, you know, it's their sixth album, they deserve to quieten down a little bit. But this song is raucous, and it reminds me of the very best moments of their gigs, which I have seen a lot of, where Matt Berninger just starts screaming and kind of crumpling against a microphone, and everything gets really, really fraught, and the Dessner brothers, who are twins, who play guitar, their brows start getting really furrowed, and it's very exciting. There's so much going on in this song. There's all these like beautiful little minimalist loops kind of threaded through it, and there is a guitar solo, a big hairy guitar solo, which has never been on a National album before, so I found this all 100% thrilling.
Are you moving into raucous territory as well then? Are we abandoning is it fine now because the National do it?
No, I've always felt like this. If anybody ever asks you that awful question, which is like, what kind of music are you into, and you really just fail to think of any band you've ever listened to ever, my stuck answer these days is like sad old bastard guitar solo music and really cheesy trebly synth pop, which I feel like are kind of polar opposite kinds of music. So no, I am not embracing rockism, but I am also very much the same broken record that I have been for a decade.
And long may it continue. Thank you so much for listening and subscribing to Unbreak My Chart. You can email us with anything you want to email us. If you have any reviews that you'd like to send us of songs that are in the charts, if Martin Jensen is still around next week, maybe we could even run a review of him. Do email us and say hello at unbreakmychartpod@gmail.com, and do please leave us a review on iTunes. It just helps us spread the word about the podcast and get us more listeners.
And if you want to listen to any of the songs that we've talked about in this week's podcast, as ever, they're in a Spotify playlist, which is now a rolling one, not a new link every week, because that was a really stupid idea. yeah, thanks for a very sensible suggestion from a listener. And you can find us both on Twitter. I am at Laura Snapes, and Fraser, you are?
At @CSI_popmusic.
Fraser is also our producer this week and made all of the great music that you heard in the podcast that was not by an actual pop star.
Yes, I'm awesome.
Yes, you are. All right, see you next week. Bye.
Bye.